Like you were saying about the mammals, the leaping mammals?
Well, of course, most of George Fresnel's monkeys ate bananas, you see. Mm-hmm. Well, I had hornbills and toucans and things like this that also eat bananas. So I used to have ships bring them in from Panama and Costa Rica. And sometimes they would even have a little snake would be in the stalk of banana. These are whole stalks of bananas.
Mm-hmm.
And we all three would go down. Chuck Shaw would go too. Because sometimes there was an interesting little snake in this stalk of banana. But anyway, I borrowed and shared bananas and different fruit, apples and oranges and pears, which George needs for his mammals, with my bird. And, you know, he only had to cut him in half, and we had to dice all of our fruit for the birds, of course. Very small little pieces, little half-inch pieces. But we all shared this together.
Mm-hmm.
And then before we had the warehouse, before we had the big warehouse and the refrigeration over there, we used to deliver everything to the monkey yard. And this is where George Fresnel was. And we got all of our fish and shrimp and things
mm-hmm.
there. And for the seals and everything, and it was all cut up and right there in the monkey yard. And again, George Fresnel, you know, would share it with us. Take it down to the keepers in the canyon with fish. I was feeding fish to pelicans and cormorants, and the aquatic birds.
Mm-hmm.
But and horse meat, you know, which we fed to the birds of prey.
Horse
meat? We used to butcher about 7 horses. Wheat, and that's a lot of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And we fed a lot of meat. And of course, again, this was for the cat strain and for the different mammals. And
so you did, at this time, there's still only 12 employees at the zoo?
Uh-huh.
And you did most of the work yourself?
We did everything. You know, we did painting, we did electrical work, we did this before they had unions, you know,
right.
We do that now.
Can you tell me something about your working conditions? How many hours a week did you work a day?
Oh, in the early days, we worked very long hours.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we worked 7 days a week. I remember I worked 15 years there before I ever had a Christmas off
mm-hmm.
as a holiday. But at that time, the curators would work a 12-hour day.
Mm-hmm.
A great problem. Because we didn't have very much help there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, another man I forgot to mention was Carl Cook. In early history of the zoo, he was my teacher and he was a curator of birds before I. He was a German man and he trained me and he did very well. And he was very instrumental in the early history of the zoo when we used to have the Hancock expedition. This is Alan Hancock. Hancock Oil Company had a great yacht. And he made many trips to the Galapagos Islands and down in Lower California. While Carl Cook was a linguist, he could speak many languages.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Hancock used to take Carl with him to interpret. And they collected many, many wonderful birds and many loopy fur seals. And many fine specimens from Lower California on Alan Hancock's yacht to Atlanta. We made many trips down there. I think Dr. Schroeder made a trip with him or so, and Cy Perkins made a trip. But Carl was always there because of his gift of doing different languages.
Mm-hmm. So he brought a lot to the zoo?
But I brought many men. We brought our first elephants, and this was way back in, like 1940 and 41.
Mm-hmm.
They came through a blackout on the ship, and these baby elephants. Great collector and a great early ornithologist.
Mm-hmm. So you got along with them pretty well?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Very fine person.
Mm-hmm. What happened to him?
He died.
He died.
Uh-huh.
How long did he work at the zoo?
He must have been there 30 years. You see, when the zoo first started, that was after the Panama Exposition.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have very many specimens.
No.
Well, Carl Cope was working in the Salix Zoo, and this is Los Angeles. And he brought his whole collection of birds when he moved down and was employed in the San Diego Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of formed a nucleus for the bird collection there, besides being with birds.
Mm-hmm. So he's quite knowledgeable.
Very knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
He raised the first walrus we ever had at the zoo. Bob fed the first walrus. He's very good at feeding baby, any baby. And I learned from him, he was a good teacher.
So he was very influential on your career there.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What other contributions did he give to the zoo? Do you know?
He made many expeditions.
Mm-hmm.
Different countries. Always brought fine, this was before we three curators went on expeditions. The first expedition I went on was in 58.
Mm-hmm.
And before this was in the 30s and 40s that Carl Cope was collecting all these things.
Mm-hmm.
I never started collecting things until 57, 58, or any of the curators. We were young people,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't have the knowledge and things to do this. But then, I say this first expedition to Australia was a great expedition. Of course, the zoo paid for it, and I brought back about $25,000 for the birds
mm-hmm.
for an expedition.
Where did the zoo get all this money?
It was donated. Donation.
Private donation.
But in those days, I said the donations was very small.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we got $5,000 or $10,000, that's a lot of money. But now they get a million.
So the main source of income was from donations?
Mostly.
Mm-hmm. How were you able to get, on these expeditions, how were you able to get these species of animals and birds? And
we collected them ourselves.
Did you also trade? Or
and we traded.
And bought some?
Uh-huh. Well, when we went to, in 64, we brought the hummingbirds, which was a very important thing, and this was the first hummingbird walkthrough aviaries ever built in 1964. My wife and I and my son, we went to Santa Teresa, Brazilian Museum of Natural History, and worked with Dr. Rushi down there, Santa Teresa,
mm-hmm.
and we brought back 102 hummingbirds.
Mm-hmm.
And we fed them all the way from Rio on our lap. Many hours. My family. And for the San Diego Zoo.
Oh, I see.
And it was this wonderful thing because the largest attendance we ever had in the zoo was about 44,000 people one day.
One day.
The day that hummingbird aviary opened.
What day was that?
It was in 64. I think it was in July.
Mm-hmm.
44,000 people that one day.
Quite a bit.
Biggest attendance they've ever had. And well, in 1961, one of the proudest things I have to offer was the proboscis monkey. And I went to Borneo, and we took a special photographer with us, and we photographed the whole expedition, and Our base was in Surabaya in Indonesia. And Borneo, Balikpapan, is 1,000 miles away where we captured the proboscis monkeys. And mm-hmm. we took capture guns and everything, you know, to collect these monkeys. And I'm happy to say the ones we collected had babies in the San Diego Zoo. And this was the first breeding record in the world of proboscis monkeys.
In captivity?
Which I had collected. And on that same expedition, I went to Bali, Island of Bali, and I got the Bali Mina, the Rothschild Grackle, the cups are... I brought four birds back, two parrots, all the permits I could get. And this has an interesting little story, too, because when we arrived in Honolulu, in Hawaii, at the international airport, one of these little birds got loose out of his cage when they was changing the luggage. So I had three to bring to San Diego. And the airport is 25 miles away from the Honolulu Zoo. Well, my good friend Paul Brees was director then of the Honolulu Zoo. Anyway, the one that escaped flew to the Honolulu Zoo. And Paul Brees trapped it and sent it to me, to San Diego. So I had my original four again. And from that four birds in the rainforest, we raised over 100 Bali Minas, Rothschild Grackle, which is still an endangered species. Mm-hmm. This was in 61.
Mm-hmm. That's quite an accomplishment.
Well, you know, the zoo has always been interested in conservation, and of course my field was breeding biology. In the 40 years I was curator there, I raised 425 species of birds, many first records in the world. And as the Darwin Rhea, which is from South America, the Brookfield Zoo and the Bronx Zoo had small numbers, and we didn't even have any. So they gave up on trying to reproduce them in captivity. So I received the 9 birds from these two institutions. And I raised over 100. Dr. Bernersky helped me with this. He was the director of research up there. And we had some real special problems. I mean, health problems and everything else. And they worked this out, and they finally got this group of Darwin Rheas. And they're an endangered species. And this was really made history for the San Diego Zoo.
What type of problems did you have? That you just mentioned?
Oh, they had salmonella problems and all different. They had leg problems and everything. All many, many different problems. But with Dr. Bernersky up at the hospital and his staff, we corrected this. Yeah, we finally got it. And now I think they raised 30 or 40 now every year.
Mm-hmm. He still works at the zoo, doesn't he?
Yes, he's director of research. Well, one of the expeditions was to Thailand, Bangkok, and I brought back hoopoes. Always like their scientific name, Upupati. And we brought those back, this was again in 61, and I had them reproduced. Well, if you read the different bird books, you'll read that the hoopoe's nest is not a clean nest. It's an older thing. But this is not true. And this is published in many natural history books around the world. And when we had them reproduce, I mean, their nest was just as clean as any other nest.
Mm-hmm.
And we hatched chicks several generations from the Thailand cuckoo. Interesting little insectivorous bird that feeds on earthworms and mealworms.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Bible, it's King Solomon's bird. You probably, if you don't know what a hoopoe is, very pretty little bird.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a race in Africa.
Hoopoe. Can you tell me a little bit more about your trips abroad? In Europe, I mean, in Asia.
Again in Thailand, we went high in the mountains there out of Bangkok, and I was collecting gibbons,
mm-hmm.
white-handed gibbons, and you had to fly up in the mountains there with a helicopter. There were also fairy bluebirds. I don't know if you've ever seen a fairy bluebird. Large bird, and each feather looks like it has enamel on it, beautiful blue.
Mm-hmm.
And these birds feed on figs. So we took mist nets and we'd place it around a fig tree. And the birds would come down and go in from the top and then try to go out on the side. They wouldn't go back up out of the top.
Mm-hmm.
And we would catch 50 or 100 at a time this way. One of the most beautiful birds in the world is the fairy bluebird, Arenity.
Mm-hmm.
And we raised them at the San Diego Zoo.
Still there.
Lovely bird. Oh yes, very colorful.
Mm-hmm. So are most of your experiences abroad pleasant ones?
Really? Oh yes.
Yeah.
Well, in Borneo, when we got the Pavrothis monkeys, we were walking along the jungle one time. These little anecdotes are always interesting. And there was a big king cobra. And the jungle paths are very narrow.
Mm-hmm.
So we were walking along. We had rifles and guns, because we were under military law there at that time. And we was walking along this jungle path, and all at once, a big king cobra just stood right up on his tail, almost as tall as I.
Uh-huh.
And where are you going to go? There was nowhere getting that. So all we did was back up. Because we was going to confront that King Cobra. But that was interesting and scary.
Mm-hmm.
And then we run out of food. We were there quite a while. And most of the people, we was that little Japanese village there. And these people eat raw fish.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't eat raw fish. I mean, I can't even keep it down. But this whole village lived on, and there was fish in the rivers there. Borneo is a very interesting country, you know. There's no roads or anything where you can drive,
mm-hmm.
like our freeways. You go everywhere by water, by boat, by canals, all over Borneo. Anyway, we run out of food there, and then there's wild pigs there. And we finally shot one of those, and it'd been about 3 or 4 days before we'd had anything to eat except rice. And we put this big pig on a spit and barbecued it.
Mm-hmm.
It was good. And yet the people in this little village, a Japanese village, wouldn't eat it because they were Muslim. This is peculiar to their religion. They can't eat pork.
Mm-hmm.
But we ate it, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, we couldn't have survived.
So you can eat raw fish.
I couldn't.
And they couldn't eat the pig.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you know, as you travel around, you have many interesting experiences.
Can you tell me a few more experiences like that?
Well, in South America, when we were collecting the hummingbirds, we went to about 17 different places to collect hummingbirds. This was with Dr. Lucy at Santa Teresa. And we'd go to hummingbirds on feed on many different kind of blossoms. you know. And there's a bird down there called a Kiskadee. And this is kind of a lookout. He's a darn nuisance. So we'd set up mist nets to catch these little hummingbirds. But this darn Kiskadee would get up on a very tall tree there and warn the hummingbirds to stay away, which didn't help it. No.
Right.
And then we went to another area there where the hummingbirds feed on the blossoms of citrus, orange tree blossoms. And Dr. Rushi had a long fishing pole, about a 20 or 30 foot fishing pole extension. And he'd put a little glue on the end of this fishing pole, and he could reach over and touch one of the little hummingbirds while he's feeding on the blossoms, long way off. And you have to have very keen eyes to do this. I tried it, and I had no success at all. But Dr. Rushi was a real master at this, and we caught hummingbirds this way.
With a fishing pole.
With a fishing pole. Long extension fishing pole. It's hard to believe, isn't it?
Interesting. Innovative. Can you tell any other stories?
Well, in Africa, of course, we got starlings, we got sunbirds, and of course, the crocodiles are very bad over there. You know, we go on some of the lakes there, and the crocodiles come right under your boat, tip you over almost. And the hippopotamus will do that too. They're surfers, and they can tip you over very easy. So we had many interesting experiences, but we always came through alive. And in Australia, when we went to about 18 different sanctuaries for the koalas. And the ticks are very bad in Australia. And we go out and put rubber boots on. And leeches are very bad. Put rubber boots on because it's kind of swampy areas where the koalas nest. And they had these great carpet pythons there. And they lay like logs. There's so many of them. You have to be careful you don't step on one. I mean, they're that numerous on the floor of the forest. But anyway, you get these ticks and these leeches. And you spend all night picking these leeches and ticks off of you. And I got Dr. Robinson, he's the veterinarian at the zoo too, was with me on this trip. And I got some ticks in my back, and I had them in there over a month, and I finally had Dr. Robinson remove them. They keep going in instead of, and finally, and they cause some discomfort, you know. So many people think you go on these different countries and the koalas meet you at the airport, or you go to South America and you think they stand right there to greet you. And you have to go way inland to get some of these. In Australia, we went out to the desert, and I went in a jeep, and we slept in sleeping bags down at Ayers Rock, way in the middle of the desert in Australia. And the water is very short, a very, very shortage of water in the desert. And we set a little ice tray out of water, and actually it was so dry and water is so scarce that birds would come in and drink water out of this little 5-inch ice tray at night, which is very interesting, you know. And you wouldn't know this until you go on an expedition.
Can you get any more other experiences?
Well, you know, the budgerica, which is a little grass parakeet, parakeet probably the most numerous parrot in Australia. They great flocks of them, I mean 10,000 at a time. And you see them come into the different water holes and drink. And then just a great cloud of feathers.
Mm-hmm. You know,
many. And the cockatiel, which I have here, is the gypsy among the parrots. He migrates east, west, north, south, all over Australia, the cockatiel.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very numerous. But many things are getting scarce over there because they're cutting things there in every country, cutting the trees and things that they nest in.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I brought the first golden-shouldered parrot, this Cephodis genus. It's the only pair of golden-shouldered parakeets that's ever been exported out of Australia. And I brought them back on the ship, on a freighter, a matching freighter. And I had a little carrying case, and I lined it with felt so they wouldn't get hurt
mm-hmm.
if they fly up and inside the little container. And, you know, they were valued like $10,000. That was a lot of money in the 50s for two birds. So I kept them in the captain. The captain let me keep those in his cabin, these two little birds. I'd go up every day and feed them, and I finally got them back to San Diego. But unfortunately, they never raised babies, chicks.
Oh, I see.
But we had many others.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, another interesting thing in Australia was Sir Edward Hallstrom. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He was a tycoon in Sydney, and he invented the Silent Night refrigerator. In Australia, and he made many millions of dollars on it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he started the Taronga Park Zoo in Sydney, and put $1 million of his own money every year right into the zoo, and kept it going for years.
I see.
Well, he was a very dear friend of mine, and every time I went over there, of course, I would visit him, and I'd take him a birthday cake and things like this. He liked it. And later in years, he became very ill, and he had to sleep right in his factory there when he was producing the refrigerators.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go up there, and he just wanted somebody to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he gave us many things, gave us energy to many things, many cockatoos, many kangaroos, wallabies, wallaroos. All the fauna of Australia, and he was very generous,
mm-hmm.
and he helped the family to do in the early years to a great extent.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other important people who contributed to the zoo from abroad?
No, but I had a dear friend, if you know Porcelain,
mm-hmm.
Edward Marshall Bean, was probably the greatest porcelain sculptor in the world. He lives in Trenton, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And when we was having the Zoorama program, he happened to see one program on the rainforest there. He called me the next day and he said, KC, he sculptured all of his porcelain work from live specimens. He had birds of paradise and really rare exotic birds.
Mm-hmm.
He called me. He said, KC, I'd like to help the San Diego Zoo a little bit. Could you come back here? So I went back there. I brought $25,000 worth of birds from his collection. And the next year, Jim Dolan went back and got another $25,000 worth of birds.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the early 60s. So, I mean, We made friends, all the curators made good friends all over the world, and it really paid off, whether
mm-hmm.
it's in the United States or in Australia, New Guinea, and of course our Kiwis, you know, we got from New Zealand, and of course Bell Benchley,
mm-hmm.
when she made her world, around the world trip, she was a wonderful ambassador, and she had friends all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So so Charles Shaw and I and George Brunell, we all tried to do the same thing, and we did. We made friends, and I still get Christmas cards from these different countries. After 30 years, I still get Christmas cards because they're real dear friends.
Mm-hmm. Can you name any other friends of yours that you just made?
Well, yes, I know in San Paulo, we got black jaguars.
Mm-hmm.
I did a project down there in Londrina, in the great Brazilian Coffee Institute. So Autori, Mario Autori, the director of San Paulo Zoo.